Hey, welcome to Urban Planning is Not Boring. I'm Sam.
And I'm Nat.
Okay.
Yay.
Hello, everyone. We are so excited for today's podcast. We have a very special guest with us, Kristen Jeffers. Kristen is a Black queer feminist, urbanist, author, speaker, and analyst, and Sam and I are very excited to speak with her and understand her involvement in the space of urban planning. So, Kristen, thank you so much for being here. We are so excited to have you, and we're just really excited to jump into the conversation.
Yeah, this is so great. Like, I'm so excited to that there's such an ecosystem now, not just of like urbanism out in the world, but so many places like this where we're talking about these things and we're listening to these things and everybody's really just embraced the world of podcasting, because that's kind of where it started for me. Media, and of course I have people who know about me know that the big origin story is, but I'll let y'all actually ask the question before I get into, oh yeah, this is how it started. But I'm so happy to be here. Thank you for having me.
Yeah, thank you so much for coming. And just as a little bit of background, Kristen is the founder and editor-in-chief of the Black Urbanist, which is a multimedia platform. I follow it on LinkedIn, Instagram, get the weekly newsletters. So it's a lot of really amazing content that Kristen puts out really often, like at least on a weekly basis. And she holds a master's of public affairs from the University of North Carolina, Greensboro, and a bachelor of arts in communication with a concentration in public relations from North Carolina State, and has done a lot of presenting, as Nat said, author, speaker, kind of extraordinaire. I definitely see you as like a very big presence in the planning sphere, which is amazing. And we really wanted to have you on the podcast to kind of talk about how, you know, you have kind of this interesting niche of being an urbanist who I feel like you have done a lot of space in like writing and kind of just trying to put ideas out there, and you have your own business, and it's just a really incredible place where I feel like as students, we hear a lot about, oh, you can go private sector, public sector, or nonprofit, but there's not a lot of conversation about, well, what if like you want to do something different and kind of just take advantage of opportunities outside of, you know, the traditional kind of 9 to 5, you know, that. I think that's why we really wanted to have you on, and we would kind of love to give you the opportunity to kind of discuss how you, the original impetus that made you want to work in urban planning.
So I'll go all the way back to when I was about, I think I was about 4 or 5, when my dad brought all these paper maps. Because once upon a time, you bought paper maps. Of course, anybody that still has Barnes & Noble or any of the bookstores, you can still order paper maps. But we're talking around 1990, 1991, when, you know, that's all we had. And so my dad, who was a licensed electrician, worked for the school system, did maintenance, like he was all into like buildings and like structures. And here I am like fascinated with like traveling on the floor. Of course, I am from the home state of NASCAR. And of course, we're years away from having Black drivers, but it's still part of our ecosystem. It was. So one of our fast food restaurants, one of our homegrown fast food restaurants, Hardee's, which West Coasters will know as Carl's Jr. They're kind of merged now, but they were making these toy little NASCARs. And so my dad had me on the floor, and I was driving to all these places. And so that was the real origin. So really it came from just being excited about like these things. And then I also had the Lincoln logs. Those are those toy logs, which are horribly insensitive because of course they come with human images that are not relevant right now. Like we do need, that toy needs to be kind of rebranded if it hasn't been already. But I love playing, like I love just building the houses. And there was Connects in the background. I didn't get a set of Connects. I did have Legos. So I had all these building toys. I had these little making toys and little car toys. And so That was implanted. Then also my teachers already recognized that I was really good with writing. My mom was a classroom teacher. She, but at the time she kind of was at home with me, semi-homeschooling me, but of course interacting in the classroom, and already they're like, yeah, she's great at writing. And we had this thing called Young Writers. And so well before I matriculated at UNCG as an MPA student, I got invited to their Young Writers Day. Like I submitted two stories, both in the, yeah, it was the first and the second grade, I believe. This is, now we fast forwarded to like 1993 and 1994. Mm-hmm. 94 is when I actually got to go to Young Writers. Now, funny, if anybody who's familiar and who has seen the covers of these books, like already I'm merging everything from my Southern culture and transportation and urbanism. I've got like animatronic jams and jellies going on trains. They're living in the refrigerator as if it's an apartment building. They're living in the cabinet as if it's an apartment building. And so that was encouraged. My teachers encouraged that. And my book was good enough for my grade level to be able to go to the campus and go meet Walter Dean Myers, the late Walter Dean Myers, very world-renowned YA writer, Black man. And, you know, it was my first signed book. And so it was just, so all those things were kind of implanted. Then for a while, because of course this is the 90s and as progressive as we were in the 90s, there were certain things that we hadn't caught up on. So fast forward to me thinking, okay, I can't make a money as a writer. I mean, because when we made these books, I was cutting and pasting. This isn't like go on InDesign with your parent and sit there and point to it or go on an iPad and scribble on it. There's so many ways you can self-publish now, but I'm going to table that to later in the conversation because that's going to come back around too. So of course, I self-published that through school, and when they had the little book and I go to the day and then I'm, you know, thinking, okay, this is great, but in my author bio back there, I'm saying, okay, I'm going to grow up to either be a teacher or a hairdresser. Like, yeah, I'm still into beauty and fashion, like low key. Everybody kind of knows about my Chris Pattern arm that really jumped up through the pandemic to give me something to do because I had time to sit. But also I was just, okay, I'll write. Maybe I'll become a journalist. Maybe I'll be a print journalist. I mean, I had, of course, I'm a Wolfpacker. I went going to a Division I school with all that sports circulating, all these legendary sports figures. I'm like, well, maybe I'll, you know, I watch these sports every weekend from Tobacco Road, like all this legacy and all this storytelling around it. Maybe I'll work at like, say, ESPN or somewhere like that. All these things were there. But I think I was like in high school when I actually opened up the like Nick's book, like the codes that you put to categorize your business. And it said, oh, well, you could be a geographer. It's like, oh, it never registered that the people that make those maps that I used to play with when I was four actually have jobs and they get paid. Okay. Like they have benefits, they have a salary, they live somewhere. It never registered that there was this whole thing called GIS that, you know, obviously the federal government had invested in it. Like this wasn't the time when you could go and create things like clearing the map or overlay those horrible redlining maps on a regular map. Like all the things we can do now, once again, we're in 2004. So there's more options. And when I get to NC State's campus in the fall, it's like a big deal that the internet is a terabyte, like speed between the computers. And of course, now I'm like, well, my phone has a 2 terabytes in it and my Apple ID, like all this technology is coming together. But I had applied originally to go into what's now the College of Design as a graphic designer, because I've always been interested in like just product design and how word designs and word ways, of course, coming from the maps, and then like wayfinding signs and color theories and everything. But of course, the way we applied in was like, we applied in, you chose 3 options. So they were in the order of graphic design, which you had to have a portfolio to submit, communication, and then civil engineering were my 3 potential majors. So I portfolioed in, or I attempted to portfolio into the design school. I show up with no drawings. I show up with my book of songs. Like I am, one of the things I haven't talked as much about over the years is that, yeah, I'm a huge like music person. I wrote songs when I was in high school. I did like DJ at WKNC, our college station, like my senior year. But that was really, that's also been a theme of like, oh, well, I could be a journalist. So I'm going to be on newspaper like my senior year of high school. So I'm on newspaper my senior year of high school. And then senior year of college, I'm on radio. And then, but when it came time to go to grad school. So I now we're in 2007, 2008. I graduated a semester early, the comms program at NC State, which is what I ended up doing. Like I got into my second choice. And even though they wanted to pull me back into College of Design, now I'm still obviously friends of the program. I've been to a lot of the College of Design's Urban Design Days in Raleigh. That's a great, for those of y'all who are in North Carolina, who are at Carolina or at even at in the School of Design and the Landscape Art program, like definitely take advantage of being in that nucleus. And of course, all the things we're trying to do and learn and maybe do well, maybe not do so well. So I graduate, I start working in the nonprofit sector. I had a mentor, Dr. Jessica Jameson, who was kind of, she's at the time, she was not our comms department director, but she has held that role since my graduation point. She has, she kind of, her and others nudged a lot of us into nonprofits to get the experience doing a lot of the marketing and media that we wouldn't necessarily get trying to go into a PR firm. I'll be blatant to say that at the time, even in the late aughts in Raleigh, like getting a job in a PR firm wasn't like happening. Now I did manage to snag an internship with Fleischmann Hiller, which is still part of the origin story. Cause then I realized, oh, so there are marketers, like developers are securing firms like this to tell their stories. And then I used to do media monitoring. And that's how I found out about like sites like Streets Blog. And of course, that's when I originally found out about Greater Washington. Of course, you know, that's a full circle moment at this point, because I'm on my second run of helping them out and writing for them and editing for them. And then I was like, okay, you know, maybe I could do this. I had a different blog called Waxing Philosophical, which was more comprehensive. I was already writing about everything I was interested in. Then fast forward, I end up leaving that internship early because I had like a full-time job working for like a nonprofit that did support for like kind of like big high growth technology companies that were looking for VC money and looking to expand. I did program like coordination there. Then I wanted to write more. So somebody helped me get over at Fleischmann. And then I ended up, our office at the time in Raleigh was in North Hills. This was, I like to call baby North Hills, where it was not across Six Forks Road. The Harris Teeter was on the original side of the road. We had one apartment complex. We had the Target. The JCPenney was still running. And then the movie theater and everything. So that it was this nice little compact, tiny example of new urbanism. And I was just so fascinated by it. And of course, it kind of all looked shiny and new. Now, of course, I also, with my equity lens, think about, well, why was it like pearly white, like the whole thing? Yes, it's a new town, but literally every storefront is white. So, okay, we're telling an interesting story here. Now, of course, everybody who's listening, yes, I know, I've seen the revision. I've seen what's happened across Six Forks Road. Please don't come after me. I have been to Raleigh in the last few years. I know what it looks like now. But there was also me, you know, I came up on enclosed malls. So of course, watching like in Greensboro, like we have Four Seasons and we have Friendly Center, and then we had like an enclosed mall at Friendly Center, but then it didn't do well. We have one of the lingering Sears's, even though by the time y'all put this out, it might close, but thankfully Whole Foods is in the basement. It was one of the first times they did that. So it was like watching all these little interesting elements, waiting for, you know, a rail system that succeeded in Charlotte but did not succeed in the Triangle region. I just obviously saw the news, you know, we finally finished our urban loop in Greensboro, whether we need it or not. It's finished now. They've been working on it for years. So what I always found was, and after I left Fleischmann, I ended up staying in Durham for a couple more months, and then I just moved back home. And when I moved home, I was like, okay, at a crossroads, it's this 08 recession. It's kind of a time like now where all you hear is layoffs, all you hear is recession, all you hear is economic change. And I'm like, well, what am I going to do? And of course, this was one of those times where I was hitting the writing and journalism industry and the PR industry. I'm like, well, what am I going to do? Am I ever going to be able to write? Like, I have this blog and it's okay. But this was well before it was popular. And so I tried sitting for the LSAT because I was also lingering. It was another one of those senior year. I think I might do this. Took it twice. The numbers just weren't right. And then I found out about public affairs. And so I ended up moving home. My typing is like, I type so fast. I have one of those off the charts words per minute. And I went to this temp agency and I took the little writing test and they were just so enamored by it. So they ended up placing me first when I got back home to Greensboro in an architecture firm, TFF Architects. Like, it was a three-partnered organization. Two of the partners were married, and they worked on things like the Fresh Market grocery store, several schools. And I was on their front desk. All I was doing was dictation. And I was maybe tweaking with the website a little bit. So I felt, and I was working in downtown Greensboro. So it was, it felt good. I was home. I was working downtown for the first time. And then I ended up getting placed. That firm didn't need me after about 6 weeks. And so I ended up getting placed at like a outplacement firm, and I worked there, and I ended up like creating the technical manuals, and I ended up doing customer service. And ultimately I knew I didn't want to do that long-term. And that's where I really kind of immersed myself into nonprofit as like social service. And like, it was this whole blog carousel of people. And one of my friends ended up starting like a personal development business. And so she introduced me to the idea of like monetizing your blog, consulting as a speaker, doing all these things, and then picking a topic. And of course, so I'd still pick this topic of urban planning and development. And then I lucked out with, even though I applied at other schools, UNCG One had the scholarship, and then they also had this focus on community and economic development. Now, under the original APA rules, like, it was going to take me forever to be able to sit for the exam. Of course, now things have changed because of other wonderful North Carolinians like Mitch Silver and others who have actually been actively working with APA to change that rule. But I was still in an ecosystem of some great people at UNCG. I took classes in the geography program that were focused on planning. I obviously took my regular course of public administration, and honestly, it's how the money gets made. It's good to know where the money comes from. It's good to know how to read an ordinance. It's good to know like how public administration and planning became professionalized, including kind of its dark histories. And of course, having that balance of, okay, economic development is this and community development is that. But one of the things that was the nucleus of literally me creating the Black Urbanist was me sitting in class. It was first semester, it was urban policy, and the textbook was just not representative. Like, nothing wrong with the actual Black human beings that have had to live in a public housing system that has failed them time and time again. And anybody else who's been affiliated and dealt with everything from like actual housing-based public housing to the voucher not working for them to what we're dealing with now with all these rents and mortgages, and are we even all going to be living in houses? I mean, we're definitely, it's starting to look like the parable of the sower days, but that's a whole nother conversation. But like, I said, okay, all that marketing training, all that fascination, this curriculum, I'm like, let me start writing my story. You know, both of my parents grew up in rural areas, something called heirs property, which is kind of how a lot of rural Black families lose land because the deeds aren't as delineated. They might be legal deeds, but because of larger families and illiteracy in some cases, not necessarily in my family, more of just, oh, well, we have so many family members. How can we split this land? Like, that was kind of the land politics we were used to. And of course, my grandmother, my mom's mom, talked about how there used to be like buses in the 40s going down the state highways to come and pick them up. Now, their road was a dirt road, but they can walk to the end of the dirt road, and here's this bus that will take them into town. Burlington, North Carolina is on like the NC Railroad, the main NC Railroad spur. It was built as a railroad town. Like, there was a lot of these things I didn't realize. Like, you know, Greensboro was much bigger at some point. Of course, obviously, textile capital, which is another reason I had started picking up textiles again to kind of have that connection as I'm moving around the world and understanding economics and understanding ecosystems in that way. But I think the big key thing was, like, I just let my interests run with me. I just kept writing. I always ask questions, like a journalist asks questions. Mm-hmm. And then one, I would say my big break, as it were, was my Twitter was found. At the time, Sarah Goodyear, who's one of the co-hosts of War on Cards, at the time she was at Grist. And so she helped me do my first personal essay for Grist. It is no longer on the internet. And that's for a good reason, because it's definitely a little out of date. I would never say we should have a great urbanism. Like, gosh, if anybody's reading me, it's like, gosh, wasn't that person who said that? And now they're like this like person. I'm like, we evolve. This is another place of evolution that I evolved to this point. And so I evolved to this point, and then I got invited to my first Congress for New Urbanism. I did that presentation, got to know that group, and then over time, like, just constantly keeping up with people who are starting to use Twitter and Instagram and start writing blogs. And I think I settled probably within the last few years on newsletters, because now that's kind of the thing. But I've had a newsletter now. I think I first started doing it in 2014. This is before we really knew how to monetize these things. This is before Substack. This is before YouTube. This is before, like, so many of the things that make this profitable now. But I still did it because for practice. You'll notice a lot of your favorite journalists might be on different platforms. They might be on the radio today, a podcast tomorrow. They might have a column. Over in that world, that's normal to have, like, different contracts and different, like, shows and platforms and deals with people in those realms. And then I also just started, people started reaching out over time. But of course, I also worked in-house. I worked in-house at Bike Walk KC doing comms. I worked for the NC Humanities Council doing comms. I worked briefly for another architecture firm that's no longer in its configuration. I was the one doing writing the RFPs and the proposals. And then I helped actually do a area plan for one of our clients that was an economic developer and wanted to do some spec work around an old Sears warehouse adjacent to a Target. Like, I wish we would build it. It's another one of those speculative things. It's like, this is never going to get built. But then I also had the gift of having something that I worked on get built. Pratt Park in Birmingham, I was brought on to be part of the team of Tom Leader Studio and McAlley Land Design. And so that's actually real and built. You can see that. So I can go see that. And then, of course, as we've kind of moved into this pandemic period, I was already kind of set up to do all this virtual stuff. Of course, I will eventually podcast myself again. It's, as you know, it's not just like, oh, I'm going to open up Zoom, I'm going to plug up the microphone. There's a little work in planning. Mm-hmm. I'm a little bit easier to write. Like, I just have that, like, ideas. And then the other side of things was kind of like, you know, we've evolved in some ways and we've devolved in other ways around gender and sexuality. And I was like, okay, you know, I'm realizing that my partner, Les, who's done a lot of transit advocacy work, that's how we met on a Zoom doing some transit advocacy. And then, of course, one, I got to the point where I made peace with who I was. I was able to say that to my religious family and others who would expect me to do other things and be with other people. And then, of course, we all kind of collided when I decided to base my operations and to go full time, working with people, contracting, building my own entity. Because like now, there's been layoffs, there's been not quite the right fits, there's been just this need for me to have a degree of control over schedule and flexibility. And yes, some things can't pay as much or don't pay as much. Some projects get stopped and started. You know, we're dealing with, like, site plans and area plans and stuff that just takes a long time. And I was like, I just need room. And my little inner Kristen who was playing with the maps would just be popping up and saying, well, what are you going to do? How are you going to feel safe? What's going to happen here? So, yeah, really, I just, I'd already been, by the end of 2019, I had still been doing the newsletter. I had started to do ads. I had pulled ads for a while because I noticed a lot of folks weren't having good experiences on jobs. I was like, I don't want to send you into the dungeon. But as we exited through the pandemic period, and as we started to interrogate these offices and these schools and everything, I'm like, okay, I can be a resource here to help you make those interrogations. I can put the information out here. You all can create a mutual relationship with me as one of the key media platforms that, you know, I embody my lived experience. And I also have been working on learning how to do equity practice better and inclusivity practice better, so I can serve a team like that. And you can subscribe here. And then, of course, I've been just crafting my own urbanism. And that's where that Black queer feminist comes from. I'm like, okay, as a Black queer feminist who is also into urbanism, who also loves to park their car and not have to use it, who is looking forward to getting back on the bike, who loves going to, like, at least here in DC, Eastern Market, and to our little downtown holiday market when we have it, and loves supporting neighborhood businesses and pumping up, like, I mean, of course, out here where we live in our neighborhood, of course, we have the street vendors, like, you know, whenever I can and it makes sense, I try to support them. You know, I'm pumping up mutual aid, like, pulling all those things together. And that's where we are in this year in 2023. I'm finally self-publishing the book I should have wrote in 2014, because I didn't have all the ducks in the row yet. But now the ducks are walking right next to me. We're out, we're proud. And so this is like the story. I've already kind of previewed that story. So if you want to read more, the book's gonna cover all of that, but that is the origin story. That is this version of the origin story in 2023, and how I just kept asking the questions and things enabled it. Yeah, there was absolutely jobs. It actually did help for me to be in grad school, but I've always been able to just think about things in a different way. And also just seeing a need to have commentary. You know, yeah, we have the planning journal, and that's valuable. And so now I think people see the need for us to have multiple conversations on and offline, multiple critical viewpoints, and of course, including communities and what we're doing, like, and in meeting them where they are. So if it's the kid playing with Legos, or if it's the businesses on the main street trying to stay alive and, you know, maybe explore models outside of like franchising and all of that, that's where they are. That's what we're doing. So this is where we are.
You know, that evolution, just your entire life story and the way that you evolved into eventually coming into the space of urban planning, although you were always kind of in some way involved in urban planning. And it's so, you know, hearing the story about the maps that you were playing with when you were a little kid. My dad would bring home maps from work and I would do the same thing. I wouldn't use toy cars, but I would like stand on the map and I'd be like, what is this? Like, what does this mean? And where are all of these places? And you look at it on a map that's so condensed, and then you see out in the world, you like are, you know, walking on your street, and you don't even believe that like a map could condense all of this space. And so I really do think, and Sam and I talk about this all the time on the podcast, your lived experience is very evolved and immersed in urban planning. And a lot of it embodies what planners are doing on a regular basis and how they're planning the space that you walk around or that you bike in or that you drive through, or, you know, just where you live. And so I really loved just hearing your entire timeline through this space. It's amazing. And the work that you've done is absolutely amazing. Just bringing different perspectives and opening up new conversations that are within this space that has long held traditional practices that, you know, either should be broken or amended or, you know, enhanced or revitalized. And so I really love that. And I'm just hoping that, you know, you've touched so much on your experience. Can you identify some of the challenges that you're currently seeing in the field of urban planning that you hope can be changed as this field is sort of evolving?
I think we could need to continue to realize that a lot of people are like me. I like to call it like dinner table urbanism. Like, we used to sit, like, you know, sitting around a dinner table discussing, oh, well, this person's moving away, or this land is in these hands, or, you know, corner store or block, like being on the block and thinking about like anything from, of course, we like to watch the crime shows sometimes and we'll watch things like Snowfall. But honestly, there's a lot of urban planning going on in Snowfall. Les, my partner, loves watching. I think it's the Raising Kanan in the Power Book that has an urban planner character, and he's talking about why he's doing it. And just, I think right now we're at that crossroads of thinking about people that use these resources having to pay into it versus thinking about taxation of the entities that generate funding and how our fee service is going to change, like providing housing or subsidizing housing and like cost, subsidizing transit. Like, of course, people freak out when you say free transit, but that's what helps people understand it. Like, it's more of a, hey, this is what it's going to feel like for the person that's like, oh, well, I don't have to carry my card in anymore, because we've already budgeted for X amount of people to ride metro or X amount of people to ride like whatever like transit system is happening. You know, I was telling someone earlier, like you may still have fair media, but you just tap it just so that people know you're there, not that, oh, you have to tap this. I totally see us getting away from having to police, because one of the things that happens is like we're policing fare gates, or we're policing someone taking shelter because they don't technically like have it or possess it, even though there's this idea that housing needs to be like an investment or like a credit card or ATM or whatever. I think just realizing that, looking at mutual aid networks, especially as they formed and fortified during the lockdown stages of the pandemic, and as they continue, as many of us are still dealing with the effects of having this airborne virus, where being in buildings is a health risk. Like, and even still looking at like how we've let other environmental issues fester, how our water quality, how our air quality has gotten to this point, how we have a health system that's so fragmented, how we're afraid of ourselves and who we really are, and afraid of our histories, and we're not wanting to read, and we're wanting to ban things. So all of that totally affects planning, in that it affects how people think of themselves. And so you might be planning for someone who has a certain view of themselves. And so having the McMansion is a show of, hey, I made it in the world. Or that McMansion is going to house the entire family, because there's multiple generations and there's multiple people. There's people coming to still coming to the United States for the hope of a better life. There's still people that living together, clustered together, like you figured out that that worked for you to actually be in your pa pandemic quarantine pod. And so, yeah, let's find a larger space. Or you purchase a street, or you realize, oh, well, my hobby actually is a good thing that I can do, and people like for me to do it, so I need a space for it. Or, oh, I can work from home like a few days a week, or we can run the store a different way. Like, all of these shifts in our behavior are going to linger. All of these traffic shifts, all of these commuting shifts, like, I think the word commuting is going to go shift into traveling, like local travel. Like, that's going to be the meaning. It's not going to be, oh, leaving your primary residence and going to a place of work. It's going to be leaving your primary residence and doing things with other people, or doing things for like your health care, and educating your children. And even like I was, we were. You know, we were playing with toys, and we were learning while we were playing with toys, like more of that activity. So I just want us to be ready for these shifts and how people have chosen to do things, and these technologies. I want us to be ready for that and not be afraid of it. I don't want us to be running so quickly to get back to 2019 and other years of normal, where we have to always be in the convention hall, we always have to be in the office, and it has to be open, and we can't like be flexible in how we do our work. And I don't want us to forget that so many communities don't get listened to. They have plans, they have ideas, they have self-determination. They are capable of creating like an ecosystem in a community, but do we believe in them and do we empower them, or do we just come in as the planners, especially if you're like in, if you're like a white planner, or even if you're a class privileged planner, like even me coming into like a neighborhood where I'm like, well, you know, my parents made sure I went to school and my parents made sure I didn't have to work during school, but say somebody else that's having to work a lot of jobs, or they're the only one that's able to make money, and all the kids who couldn't go to school, like they were teenagers, they were old enough to work. So that, like, just thinking about how we're interacting with the world, as well as thinking about regenerating things and like making sure our stuff, like going beyond like paper recycling or whatever we were calling ourselves recycling, and thinking about regenerativeness, like thinking about how things like e-bikes and like not having to think about heavy duty housing costs and flexible buildings that could be for any use, like commercial community use, is going to change us.
Yeah, I think I mentioned this in our last episode, but I think for Natalie and I to come into this like master of urban planning program kind of in the midst of this pandemic and kind of trying to see how this kind of, we have like the old normal where, you know, you're in the office 5 days a week and you're going to classes if you're in school in a classroom, or, you know, you're, the commuting time is, you know, 8 a.m. and then 5 p.m. And there were so many shifts as we were kind of coming into this program of how do we now like adapt to this kind of, I don't like this term, but for lack of a better, like new normal of like, we aren't going to necessarily see a return to what we were experiencing before COVID, because now like values have shifted and people have kind of reprioritized what really is important to them on a day to day and for themselves and their families and their friends. And so I think exactly what you're saying, like we need to be flexible, we need to adapt, we need to kind of be like envision and put into action like how we are going to see these shifts. And I think in planning, at least, I do think that like these kind of ideas have been a long time coming, but COVID really was that push that I think we might have needed to be like, okay, well, how can people like reclaim streets and sidewalks? Like we saw, you know, basically overnight restaurants were allowed to move into the streets, which would have never happened without this. And so it's like, how do we now adjust and reframe how we're planning to like better fit that? And so I think that's like spot on and just like something that is really, really important. And then also like, yeah, like community involvement and kind of one of our teachers freshman year, or not freshman year, our first year of this program was like, for a long time, people have said like, we need to give communities like a seat at the table, but really how we should frame it is like, we need to give them the table. Like we need to say, what does the community want? And how do we then as planners and as people who kind of have like a certain authority to like make things happen, like how do we make what the community wants and needs happen for them? And so I think that, everything that you said was just like totally, I feel like in line with kind of what we've also been seeing from like an academic space, like, and like our cohort and just conversations that we've been having.
Like even last semester, I took a transportation class, land use and transportation, and we were talking about how the pandemic is impacting, for instance, like downtown cities. And right now you're seeing that a lot of commercial space or office space is not being utilized the same way anymore. And so one big push is the consideration of, well, can this become housing? And especially in the midst of a housing crisis, or I personally don't like to necessarily say housing crisis. I typically like to say housing shortage, because then we know what the root of the problem is that we are lacking supply. So when we're, you know, in the midst of this severe housing shortage, is there way to reimagine space? And as Sam said, the pandemic, I think in a lot of ways pushed us so quickly to, you know, and not for the best reasons, obviously a global pandemic is not, you know, fantastic, but it definitely, I think, did give us this sense of urgency of, okay, we need to act fast and how are we going to do it? And then really it became all of these conditions or considerations that we've already been talking about for years. And then we finally had this push of like, let's, we can't talk about it anymore. It's time to do it. And I think that's just so important. And so you've brought up so many just great points about just how the pandemic has pushed us to reimagine a lot of different things that we've been talking about for so long, but are finally actually putting into action. And I just, yeah, I really appreciate your insights on that.
Yeah, it's a shame that it took kind of, but honestly, sometimes I even have said this, and I've been reading and following a lot of like chronically ill folks that have been disabled either from mm-hmm. birth or for a long time that have mm-hmm. advocated. And one of the things they say is that we're all temporarily able. At some mm-hmm. point, we're all going to be disabled. That's one of the things that we will all share, even if we don't share some of the other intersections that make mm-hmm. us like privy to discrimination or mm-hmm. everything. But that this is a point in time where we were kind of all in this together because we didn't know what it was going to do. We could have all just fallen out and died mm-hmm. within 2 weeks of the virus hitting our respective countries. And the entire globe is dealing with this simultaneously and dealing with it in different ways. And now mm-hmm. we're starting to see different levels of immunity. Now we're starting mm-hmm. to see different reactions. And now we do have tools and solutions. But kind of like in planning, we're just now getting to the things we've been talking about for years. Mm-hmm. You're starting to see that in public health as well. Mm-hmm. And also being interdisciplinary, just the fact that it's an ecosystem versus like siloed learning. Yeah. And I think that's just that legacy that we're unpacking of academia siloing and marginalizing and even not even including like us in the picture. Like, you know, we weren't like none of us on this podcast were even thought of when a lot of these schools were conceived. Like mm-hmm. there are people right now that are still like, no, you shouldn't even go to school or be thinking of it. We still have pockets of folks on the earth, even though we are all on the same globe. Mm-hmm. If anything, COVID should have taught us that we're on the same globe and we are susceptible. But if anything, it showed us that even with one controlling factor, whether it's globe, like standing on gravity, sticking us to a globe, or airborne pollutant or like disease, we're still going to apply our tools and we're going to be susceptible to that in different ways based on our resources and what we've been given and who we are and how we see the world.
Absolutely.
But I am glad that I had this pausing point because in a lot of ways, folks have caught up to me because I'd already been dealing with workplace issues. I'd already been running into being tokenized so many times in planning spaces and in community development spaces, already running into, well, why are we talking about including the community when all we should do is just go buy up a bunch of houses and make it for our own? Like those are our reparations. That's our liberation. Like these conversations are now so multifaceted and it's time, like if anything, now we're at the next phase of digging deeply within communities, within community legends and within community folkways and asking ourselves, is this working? Is this intersectionality working? Is this really inclusive? Is it really like helping us flourish versus, oh, well, we can do this and we can do this solution. And so as people who look at how things are positioned, how land is used, how we move between point A and point B on this land, on this globe, how we, you know, do it, whether we fly through the air, if we walk down the street, like, or if what devices we're having to use, if we can use them, like, we are at the nexus, really, of a lot of these conversations. And that's why you saw so many things just come about that we had already put into place. And with our relationship, close relationship to governments, and of course, governments needing to enact these like restrictions, and then us thinking about, okay, well, restrictions, okay, well, why are they here? Are they equal? Like, why do we care now? And of course, now that we've like relinquished some restrictions, why now and why for this and why, how is this working for me? And like, okay, you know, we all kind of, there's a lot of individualism now that's kind of seeped back in. There's a lot of like kind of, oh, well, we learned everything. We read every book in 2020. Why are we still having these equity conversations? I'm like, no, this isn't a trend. In the same way that like, say, stucco or mansard roofs or, you know, a certain, like the fins on the cars, like those are trends. Like clothing styles, those can be trendy at times. But just like some people like to wear certain clothes, like just like there's a whole big vintage market, both original and production, they're just like historical preservation is still a huge part of our ecosystem. All these other things are going to be part of our ecosystem. And I think we're going to, like, I think we're in our phase right now at this recording of experimenting with easing out, experimenting with thinking that we can go all the way back, but that pendulum is coming back. We're still swinging. And eventually we will be in equilibrium. And when we land in equilibrium, we will realize what we can do. You know, and in my cases, yeah, I can go outside now, but I still wear my N95. Like, and I still, but then I also have to take all these allergy medications. I also, like, you know, I'm on the East Coast. I'm on the East Coast Kaiser, Mid-Atlantic Kaiser, and like their wraparound services are helpful. Like, if anything, there's drawbacks. I have heard horror stories for those of you all who are on the West Coast, but I think the model of having healthcare so structured where you do diagnostics, where you test, where you do preventative care. That model of preventative care needs to spread through the health world, and it needs to spread through all of our public facing things. Like, yeah, we're right there because we plan. So we plan for the thing to happen, but just enacting the plan, doing it, and then getting away from thinking that companies are going to solve all of our issues. Like, tax the companies, they generate the income, instead of being so inhumane and like making us like pay extra taxes or pay extra fees. Or, you know, now I guess now we've done so much damage to our rooster and our hen population, now our eggs are like currency practically. Like, you know, this is where we're at. Or like when we had the toilet paper thing, or when we're, you know, when we are speaking up for labor issues and the answer is, oh, we're going to get rid of your division, or we're speaking up for, we need equity, inclusion and liberation. We don't want that. We want to control you for the 9-to-5 period. And we want you to sit in the desk, and all of that's got to change. And we can, as an industry, both in the academy, as well as in our offices, much like we tell our clients to do things differently, we can model what it looks like to do differently. Like, yeah, obviously there's certain things we miss. There's certain things that are great. You know, convening together is helpful. Convening together in person is helpful. But if we learn anything from looking at the photographs from the World Economic Forum, they put everything out there. They used everything and they were still able to convene. And yeah, unfortunately, we still had some folks who weren't able to finish being there, that they tested positive. But once again, diagnostics are building, like, because of the work that was done for taking HIV/AIDS seriously and taking other large communicable diseases safely. We have the mRNA vaccines. We have all of these like masking and air quality things. We have these solutions. And then of course we have the streeteries. We have the ability to block off blocks. We can see what streets aren't needed for cars. We can reconfigure how we permit businesses and how we engage with artists. And yeah, these buildings that can be converted, like, I'm just like, okay, we did this before. Now, yeah, I'm not saying go back and live in a loft with a bunch of toxic sludge on the side. I'm not saying like we normalize living in a moldy and rat infested place, but there's a solution for that too. And but maybe like the buildings that actually put in showers, you know, convert them first, or go back, strip it down to the studs and like put it together. Mm-hmm. Build 2 and 3 bedroom units so that, you know, families can spread out and home office can happen, or home like shop can happen, or all these flexibilities can be built in. And yeah, we as planners, we're now in a position to really start pushing these conversations, because we are educated in so many different realms. We're already interdisciplinary, and we have this ability to create these budgets and create this action.
Yeah. Absolutely. And on that sort of topic, and as we kind of begin to wrap up, you have alluded to this book that you're writing, that you're self-publishing. And we would really, I think that this could be, you know, an ongoing conversation that we have with you about your book as, you know, it kind of is released and the public can read it. We can revisit this conversation a little more in depth, just considering time. Yes. But we would love to kind of ask you about like what inspired you to begin writing your book. And I know that you've alluded to kind of always being a writer and kind of having these thoughts, but not having necessarily the means or knowledge or support to do so. And kind of what your experience has been while writing your book. And that book is titled A Black Urbanist Journey to a Queer Feminist Future. And I know I'm really excited to read it once it's published. And so I think as we kind of conclude, we would love to hear that. And then we would definitely love to have you back on to kind of go more in depth on that once it's released.
Yeah, absolutely. I'll go ahead and kind of summarize it, kind of talk about like what my practice is looking like right now. So really the book is kind of that, mm-hmm. like what tends to happen, as you know, like you have your textbooks. And so this is kind of the prequel to the textbook. Like I'm still kind of doing a lot of researching and mapping and interviewing people for like my second volume, which is going to be called Creating the Black Queer Feminist Urbanist. You know, it probably will adjust, but it's going to be that practice book, kind of like you have Retrofitting Suburbia and now you have your case studies. Like that's right. Like their model. And of course they both Ellen Dunham Jones and June, they're both have been mentors and like, you know, examples specifically over on the architectural side, but on that interdisciplinary side. And mm-hmm. so the other thing was I've been building a library of all these Black feminist writers. And I'm like, I want to be able to hold this. Like screen fatigue is real. Mm-hmm. And I've noticed that the internet is so easy to lose things for everything that is on the cloud and it is saved and it is here. There's so many things that get lost. Of mm-hmm. course, we're seeing that with these unfortunate book bans and everything. And part of like being inclusive is, yeah, I'm going to have a printed, mm-hmm. I'm going to have a digital, I'm going to read it. Like I'm going to work on the audiobook. Like all of these things won't drop at the same time, but I'm finally able to kind of create a team, use technology to my advantage. So I have an editor. I do graphic design. So I'm getting ready to lay it out. I've already kind of laid it out a little bit in Word, but we're going to do all the fancier stuff. Mm-hmm. I'm building in discussion questions to create a community around like reading this book. I'm also aiming it towards younger people, like to those of us who are sitting there playing with our toys in a very serious way, to those of us who are young and paying attention to the news, to stay encouraged. Mm-hmm. There have been so many times I've wanted to quit this venture because it wasn't making money. It wasn't popular. I wasn't like the voice that people wanted to hear at the time, or mm-hmm. people have kind of alluded to. And that comes back to that tokenization that, oh, well, we don't want it to be you and we don't want it to sound like this. And can you say it this way? Or we're not quite ready for this and we're not quite ready for that. But so that I don't become a true hidden figure. Now, of course, I did a virtual talk with Harvard. I believe it was 21 now, and they called it Hidden Figures, and like, okay, well, let me get this out here, because even if it's mm-hmm. like I'm just now discovering a lot of Bell Hooks's works. Now, I knew about her, but the whole library is extensive, and so that just reading through her alone could take years. Or there's Toni Morrison volumes that I'm just now learning about. Obviously, Audre Lorde, like all these people who were, many of them sometimes were suppressed in mm-hmm. their lifetime. I wanted to be able to write. And of course, we're still living through a global pandemic, and we're still living through a lot of crises. Mm-hmm. I, much like with Octavia Butler and Parable of the Sower, yet another example of a writer who was known, but then not as known, like reaching the best-selling list when they're like have been long off of the earth. They're mm-hmm. like inspiring us as ancestors. Like, I want to have that tangible piece there. I want to be able to reach myself. It's the book I wish I had mm-hmm. 10, 20 years ago when I'm trying to figure out who am I and why do I have all these interests and do I have to silo myself and do I have to flatten myself and do I have to create myself? This first book is the motivate to action. And then mm-hmm. the second book, even though we're going to get into some workshopping and workbooking in this book, the second one's really going to be there for the Academy to start thinking about, much like we use like Patricia Hill Collins's Black feminism books as textbooks, much like we assign a lot of these other books in the Academy. I want to write that practice book that has that traditional publisher, but it's still accessible. I don't want it to be so inaccessible that it's another textbook you don't buy because it's too expensive. Like right. I've been there, mm-hmm. but I want us to really start thinking about practice and encourage people from the lenses, whether, yeah, it's a racialized lens, it's a gendered lens, but it's a lens that we have, putting all of our lenses on the table and examining everything through those lenses to see how we come back together as an ecosystem. Mm-hmm. Much like we have all these different animal creatures and they have differences, but they work together. Well, some of them, granted, others are also like in the food chain, but maybe we as humans can be less food chain predator and prey, but I can motivate people to use this. And of course, I wanted another piece to have so people would have me come and talk again. I love teaching. I love lecturing. I love telling stories. I love sharing stories. I love doing things like doing these podcasts. So just for me personally, this was my catalyst to get back into that. Mm-hmm. And this was me at year 13 of doing my practice work, establishing, okay, this is what the first 35 years of my life has looked like. Now we're going into the next phase. This is what my planning work has looked like. And it's given me now space, now that I kind of emptied my brain a little bit, to do all the other art stuff and do all the other community mentoring and work and, you know, just be a human versus being a human that's in this box, that's this name, this brand name, like branding myself versus just being a human that does things that are cool.
Amazing. Well, I think that it's a bummer that you're not in California, because I could totally see this being a class that I would love to take if it was offered in our program. And I definitely feel like this, both your story and this kind of initial volume and the more practice-based being used in classes in planning programs throughout the country, throughout the world. So I am really excited for you and for kind of finally seeing this long journey that you've been on come to fruition and kind of come to this point where it is, you know, I mean, going to be released. And I I'm really excited to read it and to see how it just continues to, you know, make your name be one that is like a household name and planners and not planners. Yeah. But yeah.
Yeah. And just for housekeeping, like we're aiming for like a May, June release. Like a portion of it will be, some element of it will be released around May or June. Right now, my editor, I want to give her time to really mm-hmm. dig through it and give me time to lay it out, and then me time to start like reaching out. So one of the calls to action right now, if you're listening to this mm-hmm. and it's like March, April, like I'm looking for reviewers. I'm looking for people who want me to bring this course and this this kind of curriculum to your school, whatever level you're at, K-12, Masters of Planning, undergraduate classes, sociology, public health, Black studies, queer studies, like any, or your community entities, your community organizations. And then, of course, you know, I will absolutely be able to work with sponsoring, like if you want to purchase books in bulk, like that is the beauty of self-publishing. I will have control over the workflow. It will have an ISBN on it. It can be, it will be able to be ordered in bookstores. I just need to get the audio ready. Like that's a lot of the reason I, and the reason I self-published is because I wanted to have control of this narrative. Now, the textbook may come out with a partner, but there's, for those of you who are thinking about, like, say you decide to write your thesis up and make your thesis a book, research self-publishing and see if it makes sense for you. The number right now is like, if you sell less than 15, if you think you're going to sell less than 15,000 copies, it might be better to go ahead and publish your book. Now, I could push past that and still get the support, but just start out by learning the process. Just like we learn how to plan, and many of us are already doing the report designs and InDesign. You got that skill. You've already drawn your maps. You already have to like do your engagement, like we present at council or present the class. Like so much of what we do in this profession prepares us to write our own volumes and release our own practice books and release our own teaching materials and create our own teaching materials. So yeah, and everybody has a story. That's why I'm kind of leading with me, because it's me is what makes it unique. So make your story unique. And one thing I want to leave folks with in lieu of this coming out and everything is, if you're finding yourself being silenced in some way, shape or form, continue to speak up. Find your help, as I think it's attributed to Mr. Rogers, you know, find your helpers, find your mentors, find your leaders. You might have to like go on the internet and find them. You might have to go to the library and find them. They might be ancestors, so you might just be reading about them, but their wisdom is there for you. But then there you have peers, you have people in other parts of the world that are doing what you want to do and that support you and that love you for what you're doing. And so if you want to be a planner in this vein, if you want to be community minded, this is the best time ever. Like it's, the world has changed so much. And that's why I'm like, I'm thrilled to be here on this podcast. I'm thrilled to support all the other different podcasts and just be a resource here, like to say that it is possible to do this. Like I'm now at a point where I can say it is possible to do this. So anybody else saying don't be like me, and I've heard it, people have said it, people have tried. I hope those folks who say that are examining what's making them say that and what's making them threatened by the idea that we are controlling our stories, even as we're in a sort of like a regimented and regulated industry, like the industry and the government side of planning versus just, oh, we're going to make things in the community and we're going to lift mm-hmm. ourselves up.
Yeah, man, that's great parting words, truly. And so appreciated. I think, you know, I took a lot from that. So I know someone listening is probably definitely also feeling the same way. And just thank you so much for chatting with us. We really appreciate it. Just taking the time and sharing your experience and sharing the work that you're doing, because it really is important. And, you know, regardless of who is listening or reading, you know, we do need multifaceted perspectives and we do need diverse perspectives in this space, because again, we're serving people that are not, you know, from the cookie cutter mold. It's, we're all diverse and different in our own respects. And so I really value everything that you've said today. And I really appreciate you for coming on. I know Sam does too. We were really excited to have you. So thank you so much. And we just look forward to talking with you more once your book is released.
Yeah, absolutely. Looking forward to being back here. And of course, let me not forget to tell people I'm where I'm always at, theblackurbanist.com. You can click on view or subscribe to the newsletter. If you're already in Substack, you can search for The Black Urbanist and mm-hmm. you'll find it there. I am still on Twitter. Like I've been trying to get on Mastodon. So if you search for my name, like even my given my name, Kristen E. Jeffers or The Black Urbanist, yes, it's me, but that mechanism, it might be working by the time you listen to this, but I'm still kind of getting there. But I'm still on Twitter as long as the site is up and running. I'm still on Facebook. I'm still on Instagram at Black Urbanist. I'm also, or you can just Google me and find various things. And if you want to reach out to me, the best place to go is to go on my website, and you can reach out to my contact information there, my calendar as well. So
amazing. Yeah. And Sam and I will plug all that information as well in writing on the podcast bio so that people have access to that as well.
Yay.
Thank you so much.
Thank you. Thank y'all.
Thank you so much for listening. We really hope that you enjoyed this episode of Urban Planning is Not Boring. If you did, please remember to send us to your friends and follow us wherever you get your podcasts.
Remember, guys, urban planning is not boring.
No, it is not.